Heyo! Welcome to a special interview on We Talk Music, featuring Brett and Mo and our super extra special guest, Patrick Muzingo from the rock band Junkyard. Pat, how are you doing?
Good. How are you guys doing?
We are super good.
I'm a little disappointed that he referenced you as the special super extra guest, super guest or whatever, and he just said it's Mo. You didn't. I didn't get any.
Well, yeah, we're interviewing Mo, right?
Yeah. So tell us, Mo, what's your latest project?
The interview.
Well, yeah, Mo, what's going on with you? We heard some things that we heard some dramas going on.
Yeah. No, you're wondering what I'm up to. It's about 280, I think. It's a little embarrassing.
You going for that whole magic dance vibe thing?
Yeah, pretty much. I'm the entire tribe. That's something I actually wanted to ask you, because I know you're big into the skateboarding.
Yes.
Is skateboarding good for losing weight?
Do I find what?
Is skateboarding good for losing weight?
For losing weight?
Yeah.
Oh, well, no, not at all.
No, okay, I didn't think so.
Well,
you
break
skate
the skateboard
and then you drink beer afterwards. So.
Oh, okay, I didn't think so. I was thinking, because I wouldn't really need a skateboard. I would need, like, a skate flatbed truck, something a little more intense.
Yeah,
skateboarding thing is, it's funny, too, because, like, basically, like, you know, back history, I'm sure everybody knows the back history of the band, being that we all came from, 1980s punk rock bands that we, Brian, coming from probably one of the biggest hardcore bands to ever come out of the United States, being Minor Threat, and then me and, our bass player Todd from the West Coast, we were in a band called Decry. And it's funny that, you know, both Minor Threat and Decry, being punk rock bands back then, also involved skateboarding, because skateboarding has always had had the punk rock ideology behind it, where it's, you know, there's not really, when you're skateboarding, you're not really in a team environment. You know, it's like you're doing it yourself. It's you. You may join a team, but at the end of the day, you're skating for yourself. You're having fun. And it was about probably, I would say, 2006 or 2007. I was on the road with with a band that I was in, kind of a rockabilly band called Speed Buggy. And my daughter had emailed me a picture of me skating back in 1983, you know, on this ramp skating. She goes, "Is this you?" And I'm like, "Well, I'm like, yeah. Where did you get that?" She goes, "I don't know, but how come you don't do this anymore?" And I'm like, "I don't know, because I'm lazy. Because I don't want to hurt myself. I mean, you know, back in the day, we were skating, you know, pools and ramps. We didn't do any of the street stuff. We were always like the vertical." Like the Tony Hawk style skating of skating in pools and ramps and whatnot. So one thing led to another. My daughter found a picture of me, and it was on like some skateboarding thread or whatever. So I joined the thread. Next thing you know, I started chatting with people that I have not seen in years, because I used to do it semi-professionally in my teenage years while I was doing punk rock. I was also skating and, you know, entering contests against, you know, the Tony Hawks and, you know, people like that. And so I was like, when I got back home from being on the road with Speed Buggy, I went out and did some research and found that there is skateboard parks everywhere and that pools are still out there to skate and they're even better. So I went and bought a board and, you know, I bought safety equipment, of course.
That's because you're a father. That's what you got to do.
What's that?
You're a father, so you got to do that.
Yeah, especially when my daughter's yelling at me, it's like, "You better put on some knee pads, otherwise you're going to hurt yourself." And I'm like, wow, who's the parent? Who's the kid now? So it was one of those things, like, you know, everybody says it's like, you know, it's like riding a bike, you get back on it. Unfortunately, you know, with skateboarding, it's all really muscle memory. And over the years between, you know, 1983, I think I quit skateboarding in 83 to 85. From 85 until 2007, I didn't even step on a skateboard. So when I got back on a skateboard, it was not like hopping right back on a bike. I fell all over the place. I was just, you know, slammed, you know, busted my knee up, busted my ankle up. But it was a nice, it was a fun pain. It was like a memorable pain. It was, you know, everybody likes to go back to their youth. Unfortunately, my youth involved really hurting myself.
No, I know. Me and Brett, we're going back to our youth. We just recently bought a Genesis, and we're going to start playing some Sonic. So that's
there
our
you
youth.
Go.
There
yeah.
you go. There's our youth. Not quite as active
or
as
you
yours.
Or you can buy Nintendo and, like, play Skate or Die, you know?
Oh, that was a great game. Oh, I love that game.
That's technically as close as we got to skateboarding. So.
Yeah, pretty much. I'm glad you kept on referencing Tony Hawk, because that's the skateboarder I know. But, I mean, it's kind of crazy. You see the success he had, and he's not the only one to, I guess it was one of your contemporaries or peers back then who ended up making a bunch of money doing this. I mean, I can't imagine any of you guys thought that you could do that at the time.
It's amazing. Like, Tony had a really, I mean, you know, and I skated in contests, like, when I was 13, you know, Tony was in the same division that I was in, where it was like the 11-year-old to 13-year-old division. And he was, I think, 10 or 11, but his support system with his father was huge. And back then it was a trip back then, because unlike now, you know, like right now you got kids that are 11 years old that are skating, that are ripping it up. They're better than Tony Hawk ever was. But the only problem is you got this, it's almost like the equivalent to soccer parents. Uh-huh. So you got these parents that are yelling from the other side of the fence at their kids, you know, drop into the pool, do this, do that. And these poor kids are like, you know, shit, I can't do that. I'm going to hurt myself. But the kids just rip it up these days. And unfortunately, like I said, it has to do more with, like, them wanting to make money off of their children rather than kids doing it to have fun.
Like you said like hockey parents, right? You're talking to
what's that?
You said like hockey parents, right? I think
exactly.
Hockey parents, yeah. Not soccer. I mean, we're Canada.
Exactly. Yeah. I forgot Canada. Right.
Yeah. Come on. We don't. What's soccer?
Our CFL parents, you know.
Oh, yeah, there you go.
But they all want their kid to be the next Doug Flutie.
I'd be all right.
But, you know, it's interesting, because I think that it's like in the case of skateboarding and almost like music too, is that, you know, skateboarding has now become more mainstream, and music was always mainstream, but it's become so much easier for just everybody to do music. So I think that now, you know, there's probably more competition to even do anything.
Oh, it's very true. Yeah. I mean, it's at the end of it. I mean, the skate park that I go to, which is like, I live in Santa Monica. So it's, you know, right in the heart of Dogtown, so to speak. And, so the skate park that I go to, you got everybody there from literally 9 years old all the way up to 60 years old. And everybody is like, you know, everybody's very supportive. It's a really good community where, you know, I got 9 year olds that are, you know, teaching me how to do stuff, but then they're asking me how to do the basic tricks. So it's kind of a cool little, kind of a cool family vibe. But then, like I said before, you got the parents that are, you know, that want their kid to be the next Tony Hawk, Kristen Hassoy. You know, they want to make money off of their kid. And it's like, you know, at that point, it gets a little, like, gross. You know, it's like, oh, come on, you know, let the kids skate and have fun.
Yeah, that's really what it should be. Like anything, especially when they're kids. But do you think to yourself, though, now, wow, you know, I wonder if I financially could have made a better life for myself skating than going into music?
And you know what? The skating, you know, yeah, you can lose weight from skating, you know, because you're sweating it out and stuff. But the main thing is, like, I mean, when I thought about getting back into skating, you know, I had to take into consideration, you know, falling and hurting myself. And the good thing about it is, when I was a kid, you know, learning tricks, I actually learned how to fall, how to get out of the trick before even landing the trick. So, you know, that was the one muscle memory that I remembered, was falling. And that's helped me a lot, even in just getting out of bed in the morning.
Well, and you know, I also have that muscle memory, and I have a new skateboard. But
there you go.
But well, anyways, it's We Talk Music, not We Talk Skateboarding.
Is that why you chose to become a drummer then? Because you got the chance to sit down.
Is that it?
Well, yeah. I mean, come on.
Like, way less chance to fall off that the drum seat.
Yeah, we'll get into
I have fallen off that drum stool many a time, I'll tell you that.
Yeah, but being drunk doesn't count, right?
But yeah, I mean, it's yeah, I picked playing drums because I could sit down, but unfortunately I picked the instrument that has the most amount of pieces and the heaviest pieces, so it's like, it's, you know, it's a give and take, so.
Yeah, that can't help with the punk lifestyle, you know, to have to lug a drum kit around.
No, no, especially, I mean, like, and Todd and I, you know, when we were in our punk band, Decry, we did about 2 or 3 tours across the United States. We were younger then, so we could, like, haul our own equipment. It wasn't a problem. Doing it now is a little more difficult because, you know, I need to make sure that I got, like, a dolly and, like, you know, about 5 of my daughter's friends helping me out load the truck, so.
Well, you know, the drummer, the hardest, I think we all agree, the drummer, the hardest working man in the band always. Then that's true.
Yeah, pretty much, and yeah. And the guy with the most amount of stuff to lug around.
Well, you know, it kind of hits a question because we were doing our research on you, and we saw a video that uploaded with band Catfish. And I'd love to get the story behind this band, but one of the things we're looking at the video and we're seeing everybody here in this, you know, this candlelit room, and everyone else is playing their fake instruments, and there you are drumming away. Is that kind of a strange thing?
Yeah, you were just kind of drumming on the like couch on the table.
Yeah, it's like, yeah, they got to play acoustic guitars, yet I had to lug in the whole kit. It's like, come on, that's not fair, guys. They got to light candles, but I had to set up a, you know, a 4-piece drum set with like a million cymbals, and then light the candles as well. I mean, I got ripped off in that band. That was a fun band, though. I'm glad you brought that up. That was with Brian Forsyth from Kix. That was a that was a fun band, and it was post Junkyard by about 2 years. I want to say it was like probably 1994. We Brian Forsyth called me up and said, "Hey, I'm moving to LA, and I want to put like a band together that's the vibe of like, you know, old blues and like kind of a Black Crowes type of vibe." And Brian and I played together for about 2 or 3 years, and it was for me, it was great to play with Brian because I was always a fan of his and Kix, and just to hang out and watch him play. He's such an amazing, talented guitar player, but on top of it, he is the nicest guy in the world, you know. And it was just a really fun experience, and you know, I ended up you know, the band didn't really do much, but I ended up having a lifelong friend out of it. So,
yeah, I mean, I love the sound. It was very interesting. It was unfortunate because it was a sound that probably, you know, 5 years earlier would have hit really big.
Yeah, it was also one of those things like when we were let's let this big truck go by. It was one of those sounds like, does the world need another Black Crowes? You know, it was right around that time where the Crowes, you know, they'd went from the first record to the third record where it was kind of like, you know, almost like the Grateful Dead vibe where their songs were like 10 minutes long and stuff. And people, when they went out to see Catfish, they kind of like got that vibe. It's like, oh, it's like, you know, Black Crowes. And we looked at each other and was like, well, you know, that's what we're playing. We're having fun playing it. And then Kix started happening again. Brian had got phone calls that people were interested in, you know, Kix getting back together. So with his schedule and then my schedule of besides being in Catfish, I was in another band that was called High City Miles with Junkyard's current guitar player, Tim Mosher. And so I was in these two bands, and I kind of went the way of playing with Tim Mosher, partly because another guitar player, singer-songwriter that I was always a fan of, and that, you know, I was a fan of his band in the late 80s. He had a band called Broken Glass that was signed to Chrysalis Records. And his band was, it was great, but him as a person, as a songwriter, I jumped at the chance because he was like, let's do this like kind of like Clash, Sex Pistols type of band. And High City Miles, you know, between Catfish and High City Miles, Catfish broke up, High City Miles went on, and we started playing more and more shows. And then we ended up changing the band name to Sucker Punch, and lo and behold, actually got a record deal.
Yeah, I really like the music of Sucker Punch. You know, we listen to some of that too, and he's got that, yeah, that California punk pop sound that was kind of just breaking right then. I mean, I kind of thought that had a big chance to take off.
And so did we. We really, and it was, those songs were, those songs really, I mean, they wrote themselves. They were, it was like, we had the right lineup. We were playing with good bands, and it just really came together. You know, after High City Miles broke up, we didn't break up. We decided we needed a front man. So we got the singer from a band called Swingin' Thing. That was kind of a glam band in the early 90s. And the singer from that band, you know, he went from having the long hair to looking like Johnny Rotten and sounding like, you know, a better version of Johnny Rotten. And it just worked out really well. The songs are great. We had a great producer. We actually got a record deal from MCA Records and went out on the road with, went out on the road with Cheap Trick for a while. And that was amazing. You know, we were stoked that they would even, have us out on the road with them, opening up for them. And we kind of, it made sense because they were kind of a punk rock band in the beginning as well. So it was, you know, it was fun going on the road with them. And then we went on the road with some other punk bands. And then the band lasted about a year. Once the record label dropped us, you know, we were just like, okay, you know, that's the end of that, you know. So we had fun. And then at that point, that's when Junkyard started to get interest. And we were like, wow, people are interested in Junkyard. This is very strange, you know. And at that time, Brian Baker was in Bad Religion. And we were like, well, how are we going to do this? And Tim's like, well, I'll take Brian's place. I'll play guitar. And then we did one show in L.A. People came out. We actually opened up for the Super Suckers. And we were like, wow, this is really cool. This is something that we could do a couple times a year. You know, get to see each other, hang out, kind of like a vacation thing, and hanging out with old friends again and play a show and, get, you know, the fans get a chance to see us. And then it kind of like in 2000, it was a very Spinal Tap moment where we got a phone call that a Japanese promoter wanted us to go over and play Tokyo. And we thought it was very Spinal Tap, so we obviously took the chance to go to Japan.
So, I mean, it's, you know, it's funny how timing is everything, and it's the timing, and you can't control the timing necessarily. I mean, I think there's also there's also the opinion that, I mean, if Junkyard had been just one, you know, 12, 18 months earlier, how big you know that band could have been. And I mean, if you were to go back, I mean, you're what, in your mid 20s when Junkyard's first album is out.
We were all in our mid-20s, yeah.
Now, if you could go back and kind of give yourself, in your mid-20s, advice, what would it be?
Read everything that you sign.
I think that's probably the number one piece of advice that anybody would give for those bands.
It's 22, yeah. I mean, it's, you know, of course, we found out most of the stuff, you know, 25 years later about what we signed and, you know, stuff like that, but... at the time, I think all of us coming from punk rock bands and doing it ourselves, you know, going across the United States in a broke down van, we were kind of like, you know, when Junkyard got picked up by Geffen, we were like, okay, we don't have to do that anymore. Other people can do things for us. They can call the radio. But back in the day where you had to call the radio station to please play our song. And, so when Junkyard got picked up, we were like, wow, there's people that actually do that for us. And on top of it, like, we actually get to hire technicians, yeah, guitar techs, not guitar roadies. But, you know, and then we had a road manager and we got to tour in a bus. So we got spoiled. We were like, oh my God, this was great. You know, of course, looking back on it, there's a lot of things that we should have done, like not toured in a huge tour bus and, you know, had these huge expenses. We should have done it the way that we all knew how to do it, the punk rock way, you know, but it sure as hell was nice not having to lift up a drum set. having somebody change, you know, the drum heads, having somebody, you know, if you got a broken guitar string, you know, within 2 seconds, you got a brand new guitar in your hand. So, you know, we kind of like, we enjoyed it because it was there to be had. And, but like you said, I think we got signed in 1987. And if the record would have just came out a year later in 88 instead of 89, I think that would have made a big difference.
Well, and something, because you got signed really quite quickly after forming, didn't you?
We basically, the guys came out from Texas, and they had a couple different, they had a different drummer, and they had a different guitar player, and that I want to say that was probably 86, and then I got asked to be joining the band, I got asked to be in the band probably about 6 months after the band actually became, was Junkyard, and the band already had a vibe going on. There was a buzz around town that, you know, this band from Texas, even though the band really, you know, it, the guys were from Texas, but it didn't form in Texas. So it kind of really just kind of exploded in 87. And like I said, it was like we played a handful of shows opening up for Jane's Addiction. You know, the crazy thing was, you know, like playing a show with Jane's Addiction, and then also playing the next night, we were opening up for Soul Asylum. And then the next night, we're opening up for Social Distortion. So it was a really cool time back then, because we got that cross-section of fans that wouldn't normally go out to see... wouldn't normally, I guess they wouldn't come out really to see us because we were playing with such a diverse lineup. So that's where...
they didn't know how to market you.
Well, at that point, we really didn't even know how to market ourselves. We were just taking any show that was thrown at us. And with the background in punk rock, we basically called in some favors. You know, opening up for Social Distortion was a simple phone call to Mike Ness, and 2 weeks later we had a show playing with them. And then with Soul Asylum, it was the same thing. We knew them from, you know, punk rock and stuff, and playing with them was just, you know, the rumors of Soul Asylum being a bunch of drunks and being like the Replacements and all that were really, they were true, because those guys were just hammered all the time. So we got along great with them, obviously.
Well,
I think that was the first time we all discovered Jägermeister.
And now everybody knows about it. But,
oh, yeah. I mean, yeah, it was just like, oh, boy, here we go.
Because you certainly get lumped in a lot with the Sunset Strip hair metal bands. And there's no...
That's true, yeah.
Junkyard is definitely doesn't have that sound. But did you play on the Strip a lot?
No, actually, our first show on the Sunset Strip was only a few years ago when we played the Whiskey. Our record label was being on Geffen. Geffen's offices were right across the street from the Rainbow. So that's about as much as the Sunset Strip that we got. We would go to our record label's office every other day because we knew we could get lunch out of them. And even though you're signed to a major label, that doesn't mean like you got a ton of money. And so we were still going to the record label because we knew, you know, we would get a lunch or a dinner out of it. We'd get a care package that they would send us home with, like, you know, cassettes and records that we would immediately go to the record store and trade in so we could actually pay our electrical bill. It was, you know, we weren't making tons of money. We decided with our recording deal that instead of taking, like, I guess a lot of bands back then, they did get big record deals. Everybody got, you know, between a couple $100,000 to $500,000 deals. Our record deal was pretty much like right in the middle. But we decided that with that money, we really wanted to put it back into the record. And that's where Tom Werman came across. And we met with Tom, and we were just so happy to meet him because he did our favorite records growing up as kids. He did Cheap Trick, he did Ted Nugent, you know, and we were just so ecstatic to be in the presence of this guy that, you know, in our minds, it wasn't, you know, the fact that he produced Motley Crue and Poison. We didn't really think about that. we thought about, you know, Cheap Trick. It's like, wow, we're going to record with this guy. This is going to be amazing. So our record deal, really, we just put it back into the product, put it back into the music. And it really paid off because Tom got exactly what we were trying to do. That we weren't, like you said, we really weren't part of the Sunset Strip crowd. We were part of what we like to refer to as East Hollywood. And we never played, you know, we got offers to play, you know, back then the Whiskey and the Roxy and stuff. And we never did it because we weren't that kind of band. We would rather play the dingy East Hollywood dives with, you know, by ourselves or with like Top Jimmy and the Rhythm Pigs or, you know, bands of that nature. And, you know, so yeah, it's, I guess for lack of a place to put us, they put us in that crowd with the Sunset Strip band.
So then you like Tom Warman has a distinct style to his producing. And so how much did he influence your sound on that first album, especially versus Ed Stasium's work on Sixes, Sevens and Nines?
Tom did, Tom really had, he came down to rehearsals and he worked, it's not like he really worked the songs as much as he worked the attitude of the songs. He, you know, there was very little that needed to be done, you know, maybe, you know, snip a little bit out here, snip a little bit out there. And he's like, well, we can fix that in the mix. You know, we can edit that out or whatever, make the song a little bit, you know, some of the songs like Hollywood, for instance, was about 4.5 minutes long. So, you know, he was helping us along in the songwriting aspect of like, let's write the 3-minute, 30-second song that this really should be rather than like making it a, having a long guitar solo and having like this huge long intro. So he taught us like kind of the power pop Cheap Trick model of like, you know, getting the song there and getting the song, you know, memorable and then getting it done quick, you know, so the song is memorable and it's not like one of those, you know, long kind of songs. Like I'll listen to Hair Nation and some of those bands, like they got 5-minute songs that are their lead track from their album back in, you know, 1990 or something. It's like, wow, that's a long song.
Yeah. I'm also listening to Hair Nation sometimes or Ozzy's Boneyard when I'm not listening to Howard Stern, which I'll admit it most of the time. So when I'm not listening to Howard,
I'll throw Baba Booey out there to y'all.
Baba Booey. Absolutely. Mama Monkey. But,
exactly.
But absolutely, like, oh, yeah, you know, we hear you on Hair Nation, like, and they're playing you, and I'm thinking to myself, you should be on, like, Ozzy's Boneyard feels like a better fit for
that. That or, like, Little Steven's Underground Garage, where he's playing, you know, it depends on who the DJ is, but, you know, yeah, it's kind of like when, and it's a trip, you know, I love Hair Nation, I'm not putting them down in any way, shape, or form. Because they're really doing a service to that genre and that era of music, and they got it pretty much spot on. But then every once in a while, you'll hear like, you know, maybe a Queensryche song that will go into a Junkyard song, and it's like, wow, this is totally like different. And then all of a sudden, Warren comes in, and the Junkyard stuff really stands out because it's not really like any of that other stuff. It's not like it's not like we're Poison, and we sure as hell didn't look like them, and nor did we want to. it's kind of like it's a different. It's more of a from the heart rather than, you know, from the mixing board kind of vibe. The stuff that we were doing back then, but with Tom Werman, he really brought the, you know, for me personally, working with him, he taught me how to play drums for, how to make a song sound nice and good and play as basic as possible, which is like the AC/DC way of playing drums. You know, you don't need to throw a bunch of solos in there, or a bunch of fills in there and stuff like that, you know, straight ahead to the point. And let the vocals and the melody ride it. And then my job is to basically, you know, bring the dynamics up and down, not to show off like I'm like, you know, Tommy Lee going upside down, right side up or whatever. But
you know, again, it's a very different age. And like you said, it's really good that they're, you know, you're being played. So that's a good thing. And you got things like YouTube where your music can be played now and people find it. So it's just a different era where they don't have to wait for somebody to play it for you. But when I go back and I think, you know, what image you guys were presented with, like how much of that is like how much is just the music? It was an era of the music video where that's not now people can release a music video with just the lyrics and they can put out every song and it can be listened to on a YouTube. But that was the era of a music video. So when they're putting together your look for a music video, how much control did you guys have over? Were you guys okay with what they were doing? Were you guys kind of like, what the hell are you dressing us like this for? What was kind of the vibe?
Well, yeah, we got when we recorded the record and we were stoked on the recording. It's funny too, because while we were mixing the record, the first record, we were in there every day with Tom and we were listening to everything. So we had, there was no get out of the studio, I'm mixing this and go away. He really valued our opinion. So as we were, listening to the final mixes of the record before, we were basically, we had a week to mix it or 2 weeks to mix it. And towards the end, the record label was down there. We were down there and we were listening to the whole thing. We knew Simple Man was the obvious choice for the second single. I mean, that was so obvious, it was right there. But we were confused as to what was the first single. I mean, how are we going to introduce Junkyard to the world? And the funny thing about it was everybody was leaning towards the song Hot Rod as the first single. And we were talking about it as, with the label as far as a marketing aspect goes, it's the video could be really cool, us driving around in, Big Daddy Roth cars, that kind of vibe. And Hollywood was, it was a song that, it was an older song that we, it was one of the first songs that we all wrote when I got in the band. And it was just one of those songs that was there. And all of a sudden, Tom kind of did some tweaking of the knobs and he added some shakers to it and kind of remixed it a bit. And he goes, he's like, what do you guys think of this? And, we're sitting there. All of a sudden, it was like, whatever you did, that's the single. Holy crap. We were like, wow, this is it. You made something that was just a basically kind of like a cool, a cool filler track to really being like a cool anthem. And from there, the video ideas, my God, it just, it went through the roof. At that point, we had so many ideas, we could have made a movie out of it. And we got lucky because we also had Geffen had got done working with, and I can't remember who the guy, director was for Hall, the director's name was Jean Pelleron, the guy who directed the Hollywood video, but he was doing another band on a Saturday. And he had submitted a treatment that was what you see in the Hollywood video. We didn't change anything of his treatment. It was perfect. But his going back, and this goes back to, again, being the punk rock attitude, and we are punk, we are just a bunch of punkers anyways. He goes, listen, if we do this, I can do it on a Sunday. And we can, and I have this, I have all of this video equipment laying around that I have to turn in on Monday. So we can do this video for, $20,000 instead of $150,000. And, but you guys have to be willing to, go along with my ideas because we've got to shoot this, in the daylight. So we've got 8 hours to shoot this. And we just did it guerrilla warfare shooting. We, he found some dumpy old house that was about ready to be demolished. And we went down there and we got a permit and we shot it. And it just came together perfectly. The loose script was us driving around and us, getting together and playing in a broken down house. And the video really, it really explained who we were. We were a bunch of punks that liked to squat in a house for free.
So
and drink as much beer as possible.
So there was no deciding to use hands off,
single. Oh my God, that would have been the best video ever. Unfortunately, yes. You know, there would be probably one scene in the video that would have been deleted.
Yeah, it worked for Madonna.
It did. You know, she had the money and the lawyers, but.
Yeah, because I mean, between hands off and clean the dirt, I mean, you've definitely got a great sense of humor in your music too.
Oh, absolutely, and you know, with hands off, I mean, I don't know if really, I mean, like hands off, clean the dirt, Simple Man, Slipping Away. I think out of all those slower songs, we really refer to them as the slower songs rather than the ballads, because to us, Simple Man is basically just a slower song. Clean the Dirt is a slower song, but it's not like the we never like to use that word ballad, because
it's not every rose has its thorn.
Exactly. It's like, yeah. It's like, oh God, that, it's like, oh, that typical recipe for a ballad. It's like, oh yuck, you know. And with Slipping Away on the second record, that was that's where we actually went the way of, well, let's do a ballad. And we did it, but we also had Steve Earle co-write it. So then it became a little less of a ballad than it could have possibly been, because it could have possibly backfired and been a ridiculous ballad. And our decision on not shooting a video for that was probably the best decision we ever made, because I don't think it would have worked, you know, as far as a video sense. You know, we weren't a bunch of pretty boys that were going to be sitting around and like the Poison video where, you know, they get pulled off stage because, you know, old poor guitar player passed out because, you know, he's been working the stage so hard. It's like such a contrived video, you know, but, you know, it's just that wasn't us. So that with the second record, you know, jumping ahead, the second record, the second single for us was Misery, you know, and Misery was always a song that we loved. And we really wanted to have a more of a performance piece. And we shot that while we were out on the road with Lynyrd Skynyrd. And again, it was guerrilla warfare video shooting. The guys that shot it, as soon as they left, they were out on the road with us for 3 days when we were out with Skynyrd. As soon as they left to go do Nirvana's first video. They went and did Smells Like Teen Spirit. And so that was like, you know, we worked with a lot of guys that weren't necessarily, I guess, quote, hair band video guys, you know, and I think that really showed in the videos that we did.
Well, I love the video that you posted on your YouTube channel for with the Headbangers Ball, because I think that was just before the Skynyrd tour, because
that was all the time in the world. That was the one with the pool ball. It was very Vegas vibe. We were all into gambling at that point.
It's hilarious.
It was again, you got to have that, you know, you got to have a little bit of comedy in there to break it up. Otherwise, you know, if it's too serious, then it's like, oh God, just, you know, ugh. You know, you got to have some comedy in there. You can't take it too serious. But that was a fun video to shoot. That was also a Geffen's attempt at trying to clean us up a little bit. And basically, it was kind of a funny thing because, I mean, we were even laughing about it while we were shooting the video. I mean, we had to have, we went to a wardrobe person. And it was like, we're like, we never went to a wardrobe person ever. And for all the time in the world, we met with this girl, and I'm sitting there talking to her about what pants I'm going to be wearing. And I'm like, what are we talking? Why? What does it matter? What? I'm sitting down. Nobody's going to be looking at my pants. And she's like, no, we get you some nice suede pants. And, we'll get a vest on you and you make it kind of look like, you know, we'll make you look like the singer from The Damned, you know, we'll slip your hair back. But, and I'm like, what? I'm like, you're crazy, you know? And the other guys are like, okay, let's get you some nice Western shirts. And we were like, okay, fine, sounds good. And then, you know, you got David there with a huge eight ball that breaks the, you know, the little model of the set at the end of the video. You know, and that was pretty much, I think we even took our clothes that were made from that video and threw them in there and tried to light them on fire or something.
Yeah, that's a crazy. I mean, yeah, it's a, you. I mean, every time you tell a story here, I go, okay, I have 50 more questions. What's it like to be with this person or that person, or what's it like? But one thing I do want to know. I mean, it's a crazy time back then. There was actually cards, memorabilia cards made of bands from that era, and there's a picture out there of you on eBay of the card, and it's hilarious.
Oh, cards, the trading cards.
Yeah. Do you remember those at all?
Yeah.
I mean, it's $30 for your card on one site. Another site, it's $1.50, and it's $20 for the entire set. I'm like,
we didn't. Yeah, we heard. It was funny. We were with a merchandising company. Like when we got picked up, we didn't understand any of this stuff. So we kind of went with, and we also didn't have a manager. When we got picked up, we had a management team that when we got signed, they agreed, okay, we've taken you and we've got you signed. We're now done because we can't go any further. Our management team also ran, probably next to Cat House, the biggest, the biggest nightclub in the world for LA, which was called Scream. And they would have, like I said, they would have Jane's Addiction headlining one night, and then the next night would be, you know, it would be Guns N' Roses, and then, you know, they would be us, and it was a scene in Hollywood that was really happening, and the people that ran Scream, which is Gail Gloria, who runs the Viper Room now, and then Michael Stewart, who runs a bunch of dance clubs even to this day in Hollywood, we had those two people on our side. And they were really helping us along and getting us on some really good shows. You know, for instance, like I said, the show that we got signed was Jane's Addiction, us, and Soundgarden. But they would also throw us on a bill with, like, the, you know, brand new bands like, you know, Alice in Chains, you know, and stuff like that. So they really knew how to mix things up. And I think that's where we were really, like, we thought, like, once you got signed, you kept on playing those kind of diverse shows. But instead, you know, we got signed, the management company, we were done with them, and we recorded our first record with Tom Werman and everything. And as we were mixing our first record, we started interviewing managers. And it was such a weird way to do things because we, you know, everybody to this day even asks us, like, well, how did you guys have direction? You know, who directed you guys and, you know, who made the decisions on what you guys needed to do business-wise? And, you know, it came down to we were making the decisions because of our punk rock past. We knew how to, you know, each one of us managed our old bands or had some kind of part in it. So it was, you know, it was kind of simple until we were like, we need to have a manager. We need to have a real person come along and do the day-to-day stuff. Somebody to go to bat for us, like to open up for bigger bands and us to get, you know, they could go to the record label and ask for more money for tour support. And that's where we, you know, we interviewed a few people and our manager, when we decided to sign with our manager at the time, it was a guy named Steve Barnett, and he handled one of our favorite bands, which was AC/DC. So we were kind of like, if we sign with Steve, then we're on the same, our manager also manages AC/DC. We should be able to get on an AC/DC show. We were stoked. We were like, oh, this is great. And we signed with him. And the things that he talked about future wise, you know, we were like, oh, this guy's got the vision. He's got the ideas. And then, about a few months after we had signed with them, we were doing some, we were back east in New York doing some promotional stuff. And we found out that, that Steve Barnett does not like to mix the bands that he has on his roster. And we were like, wait a minute. so that means we're never going to play with AC/DC.
Oh, shit.
And he said, well, basically, yeah, I don't like to mix my bands.
I can't even imagine the thought process of that.
Yeah, that's got to just sink you. It's like, oh.
It was Christmas morning, and we got no Christmas presents.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
And it was, we were like, oh, wow, you know, bummer, you know, we were like, oh, shit, we're not going to be, who are we going to open for? Because, and the guys are going, well, you guys are a headlining act by yourselves. You guys can go out and play the clubs and all that. But we were like, yeah, but we want to open up for a bigger band. Like all of our friends were opening up for, you know, Ozzy and Motley Crue and opening up for the Cult and, you know, Guns N' Roses and stuff. And there's us, you know, oh, we're going out on the road again by ourselves. But, you know, of course, we were doing well, though. We were doing, we were self-supportive. People were coming out. We were packing it in every night. But we still didn't have that, you know, we didn't have that arena show under our belt. And, I'll give it to Steve Barnett. He tried. He really went the extra mile. He tried to get us on a lot of opening act, a lot of shows, a lot of tours, and a lot of bands just really didn't want us on the road with them. And we think it's because, you know, maybe they were scared of us. You know, or maybe, you know, I don't think Whitesnake and Junkyard would have been a good tour, but, you know, at the time we probably would have taken the tour just to be on a big stage. But instead we went out and did a co-headlining tour with Dangerous Toys, which was amazing. It was so much fun. And that was about the extent of it, you know, co-headlining with Dangerous Toys. And then every once in a while we did a couple of shows with Extreme, which did not work well at all. Us and Extreme, not a good lineup.
I imagine.
You mean, you guys backstage, was it a weird vibe? Just because you're different personalities and different styles, or
just the music and the
audience that you draw is so different?
Yeah, it's like throwing, you know, I it's hard to even compare one band with another, but the people in Extreme, you know, the band was okay. They were nice. But the crowd, I mean, we had a crowd that wanted to, you know, form a slam pit, during a ballad. during our, you know, Simple Man, you know, to use, you know, to go back to, we have to, you know, brand this as a ballad. So, yeah, we would play Simple Man and we'd have a slam pit. Where then you have Extreme that goes on right after us, and, you know, the crowd's all like, you know, they get the Bic lighters out and they start doing their thing, and it's like, wow, this doesn't work well together. We need to play with a more harder edge band. So at that point we were like, okay, we just need to go out and do it ourselves and just keep playing and keep hitting the road and, you know, just keep headlining the same clubs that we would have played with Extreme anyway. We just kept on going. And we ended up, we got, I want to say off the first record, we did probably four really good solid tours. And one of the tours was, you know, a co-headlining tour with Dangerous Toys, which was, it was fun. The guys were nice. It got out of hand every night.
Go figure. I mean, Dangerous Toys, I can't imagine, right?
It was a tour that started in St. Louis and ended somewhere, because I can't remember. At one point, I want to say the road manager for Dangerous Toys tried to separate the bands. Like, you guys need to stay at a different hotel. We need to separate the guys because they're just partying too hard. And we're like, what are you talking about? We're all adults here. And it's like, wait, who works for who? You know, you can't tell us not to hang around with those guys, but there was a lot of fun nights. It wasn't like the stories, I guess, that you would hear about, like, well, you know, Faster Pussycat and Motley Crue touring together. That was probably a fun tour for Faster Pussycat and Motley Crue, but at the end of the day, you get Junkyard and Dangerous Toys together, and it's like, you know, you are putting it on 11 and you are pulling the knobs off. You are making sure that nobody drives a car. And it's, you know, it was, we were just wrecking things left and right. We didn't do the typical thrashing of the hotel rooms. We went to people's houses and, like, you know, messed up their house instead. Yeah, we didn't. We were also very, you know, we were approachable. We weren't the band that hung out backstage and hid from the crowd and all that, you know. We had more fun, you know, going and hanging out with the people that were at the show because, you know, we see each other every day when we're playing. Why do we want to hang around with each other right before we have to play? Let's go hang around with other people.
Well, I'll tell you what, if you ever come to Calgary, I am inviting you over to Mo's house.
Oh.
There you go. Perfect. And we'll come. We'll have a great old time, man.
Oh, you'll come. What the hell?
So, yeah, it was an interesting time. And, you know, the guy, we were with, like, you know, we were with an amazing booking agency. And they just, you know, they were like, well, you guys are going to go out again by yourselves, except you're going to hit the Pacific Northwest. And then you're going to hit, you know, you guys are going to hit Florida now. Now you're going to do the East Coast. Now you're going to do this. And it worked out well for us because it kind of pretty much established us as a national touring act without having to open up for a bigger band. But it also goes back to what you guys were saying. If our record would have came out 12 to 18 months earlier, it would be a completely different ballgame, I think.
You know, I was actually going to ask you, I mean, we have a lot of questions and I don't know how much time you have. We want to get them talking.
I got all the time in the world.
We're having a blast here. And yeah, you know, I was going to ask you because some of the funnest guys to be on the tour with, but you might've just answered that one. So who is the guy who makes you laugh? Who are the guys that like are the funniest, maybe a good prank story, a good road story? What's something that kind of pops to mind that you just go, holy, I just shake your head and you start chuckling, thinking about?
Pretty much everybody in the band. I mean, we just like to make fun of each other. And then, you know, we'll get, we never really had fights on the road. We never had, we got along as friends, you know, cause we, like I said, we all grew up, you know, in the same scene. We all knew each other from other bands. We've all been, you know, we've all played the same places in other bands, you know, during punk rock. And, you know, so we really, like, as far as that time period for the first record and even the second record, when we were touring, we never had an argument between a band member. I mean, we just had such a blast being out there. And probably, you know, there were some pranks. For instance, like we did a mini tour with Rhino Bucket for the Sixes, Sevens, Nines record. We went to England and we opened up for Ricky Warwick's band, The Almighty. And we were in heaven. And we had just switched bass players. Clay decided he wanted to go do something else. And so we brought Todd in the band Todd and I were in Decry together. So, you know, bringing Todd in the band just brought it full circle. So we were just a family. I mean, you could not separate the five of us. So we went to England. We had a great time touring with them, with the Almighty. We had a great time, you know, touring England. I mean, we were there for 2 weeks. I mean, we played every small town in England you can imagine. And, as soon as we got off the road from England, we came back to Los Angeles for 2 weeks, and then we were out on the road again for 2 weeks with Rhino Bucket. And that was another great band to tour with, and another great band that, you know, to this day is just, I love those guys. You know, they're great, and they've really stuck to their guns, and they sound even better than they ever sounded before. And, you know, song-wise, their new stuff is great, just like their old stuff is.
And they sound like AC/DC, so you kind of got the...
What's that?
And they sound like
AC/DC. It's like AC/DC and AC/DC playing together.
Yeah.
But we did a two-week mini tour with Rhino Bucket that basically was our warm-up tour, and then we met up with Lynyrd Skynyrd Nashville. It wasn't Memphis, it was Nashville. And that was our first and only arena tour. And we were so just like the MTV record release party that we had for Six to Sevens, Nines. We knew we were going to England. We knew that we were going to go out on the road with Lynyrd Skynyrd. So that year we were so excited. And they pre-released All the Time in the World. And that was really doing well. It was getting a lot of airplay. It entered the charts, which for us was a weird thing, that the single entered the charts at like number 24. And we were like, wow, this is great. And they released a record, and that was about, I want to say that was about 6 months before SoundScan happened. And all of our stuff prior to that was not SoundScan. So that, and you guys know what SoundScan is, right?
Yeah.
So basically, you know, our first record, when we started recording Six and Sevens and Nines, we were told that our first record was on the way to becoming certified gold, that we had sold approximately 350,000 units. And we were like, that's great. That's cool. So our second record should at least get gold. And they're like, no, we're planning on it. And we were stoked also that we got a 4-star review in Rolling Stone. I mean, we're like, oh my God, you know, that doesn't happen with a band like us. And so the expectations were really high while doing Six or Sevens, Nines. We also chose Ed Stasium to produce the record because he got the band. It was, again, going back to, you know, this guy did the Ramones. He did Motorhead. He did the Smithereens. He did Living Color. He did the bands that, you know, we like those bands. The sonically, the records that Ed Stasium has done, even to this day, are just amazing. And so the label were really happy when they were hearing rough mixes. They were amazed. It was great. Sonically, I think Six or Sevens, Nines, I think it really is a good sounding record. I mean, the bass sound, the drum sounds, the vocals, the guitars, everything just was like, it just worked out well. It was like we made a really good cake. Now we get to put the icing on it by letting the public have it in their hands. And it was amazing. Like I said, the airplay for All the Time in the World was huge. And we were selling, oh my God, I forgot, you know, back in the day, people would go to the record store to buy a single. You know, you'd buy a cassette single, or you'd buy a CD single. And it was like, wow, this is a trip. I mean, we had sold, I want to say All the Time in the World sold probably 35 or 50,000 units by itself, just the single. And it was like, we're going to do something with this. I think this is it. And when we got back from England, they had told us that Six or Sevens and Nines, in the first month that it was released, had sold over 100,000 units. And we were like, oh my God, that's huge. Why then? How come we're not on the charts? And that's when they told us that, well, we're going to wait because you guys are now going to go out with Lynyrd Skynyrd, and we know you guys are going to sell a lot more, but we want to wait and then release the figures along with this new technology of SoundScan. So that way, when you guys enter the charts, you're going to actually enter pretty in the top 20 for the Billboard Top 200. So we were like, okay, sounds good. Well, what happened was it kind of backfired, because as great as going out on the road with Lynyrd Skynyrd was, we didn't sell any records. We sold probably 15,000 records. And it was like every week we would wait for the sales figures to come out, and nobody was buying the record. And it was like, what happened? You know, we were kind of confused. And, we even told the label, can you release the sales figures now so at least we can get on the charts? They're like, no, we're going to wait. You know, there's a glitch in the Matrix. Who knows? And the Matrix wasn't even around then. So they waited and waited. And, you know, meanwhile, we're out on the road, you know, opening up for Lynyrd Skynyrd, watching them every night. We were just, you know, we were in heaven. I mean, it was insane. It was so cool. And we were on the road with them for, I want to say, 3 months, maybe 4 months. And Geffen called us up and they decided, okay, we're going to pull you off the road now. You're going to play some local shows and then you're going to start on your third record. And we were kind of like, why? What's going on? They're like, well, you guys aren't selling any more records. And we're like, and you guys never released the sales report. What happened? Why didn't you do that? And they're like, well, you know, we took a gamble on it and it didn't pay off. But, you know, your third record will do well.
Yeah.
And at that point, the writing was on the wall. We, you know, was grunge coming in a little bit? It, you know, Nirvana started happening. We didn't really see that as a threat. We saw it as, you know, this cool band from Seattle that's making great music is selling. You know, fucking cool. Great. Excellent. Very cool. And we started writing for our third record. And then we started, you know, not getting those lunches anymore at the record label. And, you know, our phone calls would not get returned. And, you know, so we just basically just went full steam ahead and started writing songs. And that's where the Triple X and Joker CDs came out. Those were basically demos that were for the third record.
Yeah, and, there's a lot there for sure on those two albums.
There is a lot. And you know what? Some of it probably should not have been released. Some of it we listen back to, it's like, oh no, why did we do that?
But, you know, go ahead, please, go ahead.
Oh no, go ahead, go ahead.
Well, you know, we've had a chance to talk to them, you know, for this show. A lot of people kind of coming up in that same time period as you, and we kind of consistently hear this same story. Things are going great. We're big. Everybody's behind us, and then you know, things go to shit. But what we always have heard is, but we stuck with it, and we went through unbelievable periods of personal tragedy and turmoil and poverty. But we stuck with it. Now we're through the other side, and now we're a nostalgia act, and people are interested again. We're still out on the road. We're still playing, and now we're grateful for what we have today. Whereas you guys took a different route. You guys took a different route to that degree that you went, okay, it's time to get jobs.
Yeah. We kind of like, it's not like, you know, and it's funny that, you know, I know a lot of bands have a different recollection of like grunge, I guess. There's a lot of bands that go, oh, grunge killed, you know, that music scene. Grunge killed rock. And it's like, well, how could it have killed rock? I mean, grunge was amazing. You know, you can't really call it grunge because if you listen back to it now, it was just really good music that was coming out. It was also time for a change because the, you know, the record labels were, they were really starting to get formed. They were starting with that formula. They were like, well, it's going to be street rock meets glam rock meets pop. And then maybe we'll throw a flannel shirt on one of the guys. And the record labels just got really too lame. You know, some of the acts that came out, 92, 93, that came out and did like maybe one record and then went away, they didn't have the substance. They didn't have the songs because it was basically a formula that was put together by some guy behind a desk looking at sales figures going, oh, we'll do a cross between Chris Cornell meets Kurt Cobain meets, you know, Billy Corgan. You know, there we go. We've got our act, and it's almost like the Backstreet Boys kind of thing. Let's put a band together and it should sell. But it really got watered down and it got diluted. And so I don't, you know, like, for instance, I read an interview with I think it was Phil from LA Guns. And it's like, still to this day, it's like, oh, we hate those bands, the stupid, you know, Nirvana and stupid Pearl Jam and all that. It's like, are you kidding? How can you hate those bands? They were great bands for a time. They really changed things. They made, you know, they had great songs. They had messages in their songs. But it, yeah, granted, lyrically, it got a little heavy, but, you know, it was time for a change. And I don't know. It really, I don't look at junk as grunge killing junkyard. You know what I mean?
Well, I think the assumption that the bands are making then is that you know, grunge did it specifically, whereas it wouldn't matter if it was grunge. It would have been anything that would have
exactly.
made that change.
And you know, I know that at that time when that music was hitting, I in the back of my mind I was going, I know this is good music, but I up front hated it because I felt like it was taking away what I liked at the time. But now that I look back, I'm like, God damn, I love listening to that stuff.
Oh no, exactly. Yeah. I mean, it's you know, the other part of it was you know, you had bands, you know, like I guess we could just refer to it from like the 88 scene to the 92 scene. You know, there was bands like us, there was bands like our friends, the Hangmen, or the bands like the Sea Hacks and stuff like that. Those, like, it's almost like we would have benefited almost like if we would have waited to put out a third record, you know, waited until 93 or something, you know what I mean?
Yeah, I know what you mean. Yeah, you would have fit in much better. And then, you know, I mean,
and the stuff that, and some of the stuff that we were writing, you know, like I said, the Triple X and the Joker, those were, they ended up seeping out on the internet. And I remember distinctly, there was a guy in Florida that had a CD burner, and it was like, holy shit. Wow. CD burner. Wow. You know, they're like $1,000 or something. And the guy was like, hey, I have, he's like, I got, he put a quick webpage together, like, you know, about us. And I was like, hey dude, can you send me like a CD? Because honestly, I don't have any of that stuff. And, you know, so we started listening to it and we were like, wow, this is kind of cool. And then next thing you know, it ended up on eBay. And it was like, what the heck is going on here? These are our demos. These are basically just, you know, this is like, you know, these are worksheets that, you know, we went in the studio. They're demos for a reason. You know, we didn't go full blown production with it. We just wanted to hear what it sounded like, wanted to present it to the record label, see what they thought. And then if it was good, then we would, you know, we would have had our third record, but instead it ended up becoming kind of this underground CD or music trader. Everybody was trading, you know, well, I've got, it's almost like our trading card. Well, I'll trade you two pass for one David. You know, so people were
the way
trading
around.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. No, yeah, there's like, you know, 25 paths to one David, but so yeah, it you know, for the Triple X and the Joker, the demos, you know, it really, people started like going, well, I have five songs from this demo session, I got three from this. And the cool thing about it for me was like, I was like, I had not heard these songs in years, and I was like getting people sending them to me. I was like, wow, this is cool, you know, this is great to hear this stuff. And it was never meant to leave, like, you know, our houses, you know. And next thing you know, it was all over the place. And it's like, hey, man, it's the internet. Let it go. You know, give it away. You know, cool. And we had decided that we wanted to make it a real release. So we self-released them, mostly because we were going to Spain and we needed some kind of product. And we were like, well, why? Let's package this thing up and put it together and put it out on iTunes and see if people buy it, you know? And so it's weird how it ended up coming out. And I think it may be, you know, it may be time to almost take it off the market, because it's like, it's a time that, you know, it came and it went. It was never really out there for public consumption. People that bought it, great. We're happy that you liked it, but it's time to like take it away because, you know.
Oh, come on, no.
It's,
no.
It's used underwear.
You know, it's funny though. I mean, I think of something like, you know, Janie Lane of Warrant had a similar experience where he had all these demos he had made with his Jabberwocky project, and they got out there.
Oh, that's right.
They're leaked on the internet, and, you know, because he was working on them and perfectionist and trying to get them perfect. And then tragically passes away, And if it wasn't...
That sucked. I mean, we were never... unfortunately, as everybody gets older, it does suck because, people are starting to pass away. But, for him, it was... I think we were all kind of bummed, even though, like I said, we were never fans of Warren. We didn't really like the way, we didn't like the music. We it's not like we were friends or anything. He was a supporter of the band. He really liked the band and he didn't do it. He liked the band because he liked the band. He would come to our shows and he was a nice guy, and when he passed, it was just like, wow. And the band goes on, and it's like, you can't do that. That's not Warren,
And they don't even show up for his memorial show, which kind of makes you wonder a little bit. But I was just going to say, if that's...
You're kidding. I didn't know that.
Yeah, they didn't. They said they had another gig.
That's chicken shit. That's lame.
I know. Everybody kind of feels that way. But, 47 years old, far too young and a talented guy, even if it was a different style of music. But I was just going to say, the Jabberwocky tapes got out there. And if it wasn't for the fact those were leaked out there, now we wouldn't have them. And we wouldn't have this. They'd be gone forever. So it's kind of one of those things where it's like he didn't want it. But, as a fan of his, I'm grateful because it's like, okay, otherwise I never would have heard them.
Mm-hmm. No, yeah, it's very true. I think you hit the nail on the head on that, especially for something that probably was, you never know if it was ever going to be released, if they were demo, were they demos that were released?
They were demos, yeah. And you can definitely hear it. Some of them sound great. Some of them sound like just awful, but you can definitely hear they were demos. And, a different type of music, more like a Tom Petty type style music, right?
Was he doing that kind of stuff? That's really cool.
That's actually more like probably more like a Tom Petty type style.
It was not Warrant at all. It was not what you expected. It was not glam rock.
And that's the funny thing about Warrant, and this is getting off completely, but I mean, they're one of those bands who they changed and had much more of a grunge sound on their mid-90s albums, and and I remember a quote from Jenny Lane saying, if you change, you're a sellout. If you don't change, you're a dinosaur. You're fucked either way.
Right. Yeah. You're absolutely right. Yeah. It's I'm still kind of pissed about like those guys didn't even show up to his thing. That's really pissed.
Yeah. Well.
Whatever. And then I saw and then I guess like the members of Warrant have they have their own wine company or something like that. It's like come on, man.
Yeah, I think that's Jerry Allen, the guitarist or something like that, who has that. Yeah. that's what it's like. I'll drink Sammy Hagar's tequila, but that's where I'm drawing the line.
What's that on Hagar's tequila?
Yeah. That's
but
it.
That stuff is good, though.
That stuff is good. Yeah. Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Well, that's because he put care and effort into that.
Yeah, he really did, yeah. One thing that we were actually speaking of, he's thrown out so many names of bands, and it's like I feel like we just talked to you about these bands forever, but one of the bands we're just saw a concert for the Napalm Death, and they're out there with Voivod, and I'm not sure if you're overly familiar with either one of those works.
But
Voivod, I mean, their drummer away. I was watching it and I'm like, the drummer's always stuck in the back of the stage, and the whole show I can do is watch this guy because he's just a technical master. I wish he was at the front. Don't you feel that way yourself sometimes?
No, I want to head in the back. Or wait, wasn't it, I may be totally wrong, but Rage Against the Machine, didn't the drummer play with his back to the crowd at one point?
Oh, yeah, I think you might be right on that.
I think so, yeah.
I think he did, yeah, that I'd have an issue with because I have I got OCD, so, I would be freaked out that people would throw something at my back, but that kind of thing. Yeah, it's weird because just going off on like what you're talking about, having, different instruments, me being more in the front rather than the back. I kind of dig the vibe of what's his name? Jack White's band. His current band is just a bunch of amazing studio musicians. Yet he's got the drummer that's all the way on the left-hand side of the stage. He's got the keyboard player on the right-hand side of the stage, and the pedal steel player is in the spot where the drum riser should be. And it's just, and I, when I saw that, and a friend of mine is out working for them, so it's like, I saw that and I was like, oh my God, that's a brilliant idea. You know, of course he's playing the kind of stuff like, you know, there's a pedal steel on every song, but, you know, it's like, you know, like you don't have to go by the rules, you know, but, you know, with, I guess with a rock band like Junkyard, it's like, you got to do this, you got to do the AC/DC setup. And that's one thing that we always tried to do. You know, when we went out with Lynyrd Skynyrd, that was the first time we ever heard the word production. And we were like, wait a minute, what? What do you mean production? Like, an actual stage? You know, really?
I thought you like just built it and we played on it. You're right.
It was amazing because we were just like, you know, our idea of production was simply like AC/DC. You got two, you got either a Marshall stack or a Marshall half stack, and you got an Ampeg SVT, and you got a drum set. And when we went out with Skynyrd, we got the opportunity because, you know, Lynyrd Skynyrd was so nice. They gave us half the stage. They gave us full monitors. They gave us 80% of the front of house sound. They gave us the only thing light wise they gave didn't give us is they didn't give us all of their spotlights. And they had five spotlights. They gave us one spotlight. But I mean, they didn't have to give us anything. And they were so nice that we found out this in advance. So our tour manager at the time was like, "Well, you guys can have production." And we're like, what does that mean? It was like, oh, you get a backdrop. Okay, yeah. You know, and then we built these things called scrims, our curtains that where the amps were behind it. And basically it was still the Marshall half stack behind it, but we had these things. It just looked so cool. It just looked so amazing that we had these, you know, these curtains that you couldn't see the amps. So it was just a cool vibe. But yeah, like I said, production.
Yeah, it's production, you know, but I mean, sometimes I go, production is one thing, but then I remember watching the Super Bowl and a halftime with Katy Perry, and I'm thinking to myself, it's spectacular. Don't get me wrong. It's amazing what they got going on, and they pulled all this out there in such a short period of time and everything. Spectacular. But I'm like, God damn it. I think music right now really needs the Ramones from the 1970s more than ever.
Oh, yeah, definitely, for sure.
You know, just get out there, get on the stage, and just play. So we have what's going on right now with Junkyard? We know you got that tour in Spain, as you mentioned. I know Spain's a great place for you guys, a lot of fun. You get great reactions there. No North American stuff coming up, and that tour is not until October. So what is it that you guys are busy with right now?
Well, what we're doing right now is it's kind of a bit of a story, and I'll get into it. we were trying to figure out why our second record was not on iTunes. And so we contacted one of the guys at iTunes, and it turned out he was a big fan of the band. And he said, you know, I can call the people over at Geffen and we can get sixes, sevens, and nines. We can get that out and we can get that on iTunes. And from there, we actually had a relationship with this guy. He was a fan. He did everything possible to help us out. Like at one point, we were on the cover flow of iTunes, you know, and this is like... this is like prime real estate for record labels pay for that. And this guy was such a fan. He goes, no, I'll put you guys up there. And he had talked about leaving iTunes and he wanted to form his own record label. So we were like, you know, that's really cool. And he goes, well, I would like to have Junkyard be on my record label. And we never thought about like writing new songs or anything like that. So all of a sudden that kind of gave us a bit of a spark, and we started demoing some ideas, you know, using that Logic program that people use to do, you know, to demo songs with a drum machine and stuff. And we started just, you know, writing some scratch tracks and some scratch ideas. And the guy ended up going to New York, and he was working at a label, and we lost touch with him for a while, but we still kept on writing. So it was kind of like a cool vibe. We were getting this sound that was different. It was not the Southern style sound that, you know, the band had had in the past. It's kind of like across, it goes back really kind of to, it's an homage to like our punk rock past, but then also it's got like the Stooges vibe to it. And it's got one song, you know, off the top of my head, it kind of sounds like Alice Cooper, like early Alice Cooper stuff. And it's like, wow, this is kind of cool, you know? So we kept writing. And the last show that we did at the Whiskey last year, we had some free studio time. So we went in and we recorded, we demoed a couple of songs. One song sounds like, you know, it sounds kind of like a cross between Hollywood, All the Time in the World, and Lost in the City. And we were like, wow, this sounds cool. And then we demoed another song that sounds like a real fast, it sounds like a faster version of Lost in the City. So we had enough time while Brian was out here to record those two songs. And you know, we've only shared it with really ourselves and, you know, a couple friends and stuff. And so far everybody's liked what we've been doing. So we started writing a couple more. And we're kind of in the, in a holding pattern. We can't really say too much about what's going to go on for, you know, after Spain or prior to Spain. You know, we in a perfect world, it would be nice to go in and do a new record. And it's a 50-50 shot that we may actually be doing it. So again, it's hard to talk about because, you know, it may or may not happen. I'm trying to be as vague as possible.
Yeah, well, 50-50, I'll take 50-50, and I'd also like to see
you. There you go, that's the name of the record, 50-50.
Yeah, why not? I'd also take you on tour with Alice, that'd be great.
That would be fun, yeah, for sure. So so we're kind of in a holding pattern now. Spain popped up because we have a really good relationship with the production company over there. And they brought us over... they brought us over in 2008 and 2009. And we also played a festival in 2003 with Twisted Sister, the London Choir Boys, and the Georgia Satellites. So Spain, for some reason, really takes to Junkyard, and we play in front of a lot of people. And we also play in front of, we also do small club dates. So, I mean, really small club dates, like, I don't know, 125 people packed into a small little bar. And then some of the shows that we do are playing in front of, you know, 500 to 600 people, and some we play in front of 3,000. So it's Spain is, I guess, our home away from home. And, you know, we also look at it as a way to get together and hang out and do a little bit of sightseeing from the side of a touring van. We don't have enough time to get out and do any kind of, you know, sightseeing. So we see the, you know, we basically get out of the house. We get to play some shows. So this time around, we're going to be doing, I think, 3 shows with Dan Baird from the Georgia Satellites. He's got a solo band. So we're stoked about that. Whatever happens after that is, you know, we will see. Hopefully in the next few months, we'll be able to let everybody know about what's happening.
You know, if you're about to release that new album and, you know, you can say it's 100% of 50-50 is happening. We sure love to talk to you when it's time and we can get into the details of the album and the sound and the songs a little bit more.
Absolutely. And I think if something does come about, you guys will get some MP3s in your email.
That would be tremendous. Remember, he's Brett and I'm Mo. We don't want to forget.
But the world needs more Junkyard, in my opinion.
Absolutely. Really, that's good news, even if it's just a hopeful thing right now. But we thought, you mentioned the Choir Boys and all this stuff. Mm-hmm. Would you mind if we play a little word association? We just kind of throw a name at you and you give us a story or opinion or a memory,
sure,
or whatever. And so we'll start with Spike from the Choir Boys.
Frank from the Choir Boys. A lot of drinks in Spain. I think I want to say that they played right before us in Spain, and they came on stage, and I think they handed each one of us about 20 cups of beer because it looked like we were having a hard time, and nobody gave us any beer while we were up on stage, and we were playing in the south of Spain, and it was kind of hot.
Nice.
Well, let's see now. Let's go with another lead singer, Michael Monroe.
Kind of reminds me of my grandma. goes back to Spain. The other band that I was in, Speed Buggy, we played a festival in the south of Spain, and I had known Andy McCoy for a while, and Hanoi Rocks was on that bill. So as soon as they showed up, my band had already played, and Hanoi Rocks showed up, and Andy looked over at me. He's like, "Pat, come over here. Come on, come with me." And next thing I know, I'm in a room with Andy McCoy and Mike Monroe. And I'm looking at Mike Monroe, and I'm like, oh, my God, this guy looks like he's 75. But, boy, he's doing warm-ups, and he's kicking, and he's playing the sax. And somewhere I got a picture of me and him, and it does look like my grandmother.
Oh, that's awesome. He
looks better now. He looks better now. He was, I think, really messed up then. So
Somewhere I saw a clip of you and a few other people talking about Hanoi Rocks. It looked like some sort of documentary, and I tried to see if I could find the full-length thing. I don't know what it was called, but...
Oh, that. There's a friend of ours who's doing a documentary on basically the Hollywood scene, which is the Hollywood scene from, like, 1985 to 1990. And that's and about the Hollywood scene that was around Melrose Avenue, and anybody that had worked on Melrose Avenue that also played in a band and was part of that scene, because basically every night of the week in Hollywood during that time, there was a nightclub to go out to, there was a band to go see, and this was all like right when Guns N' Roses had started. There was no. There was not one band that was taking over the LA scene, but it was basically, I guess I equate it to the punk rock scene in Los Angeles in 1979, where there was about 100 punk rockers and everybody knew each other. And in 1985-86, everybody worked on Melrose, everybody was in a band, but nobody was really getting signed or anything. So the documentary that we're I was talking about Hanoi Rocks and the aspect of the band that me and Todd were in, which was Decry. We went from being a punk rock band that sounded like the Dead Boys, and somebody gave us a Hanoi Rocks record. And all of a sudden, that changed how Decry decided to go from punk rock to rock. And everybody was like, you know, back then punk rock bands were leaning towards Metallica and Megadeth. Well, we leaned towards Hanoi Rocks, and we leaned towards Lords of the New Church and Dead Boys. So we went that way, where everybody went like really hard edge rock. And for Decry, it didn't quite work out that way. On paper, yeah, it's, you know, writing it out, it sounded good, but it just didn't vibe, and, you know, Decry ended up breaking up. But that's, I guess, yeah, where that video clip, that was from that documentary. So.
That's an actual documentary that's available? Is it on like a Kickstarter thing?
He's working on it right now. I believe he's getting as many people as possible that he's going to be interviewing, and... from there, he's going to pitch it and try to get a distribution and throw it out there. I mean, he's got some people on there, like everybody from Keith Morris from the Circle Jerks to me from, you know, Junkyard, to he's working on members from Red Cross. You know, it's the whole gambit, the whole, you know, everything from punk rock to glam to
his name is...
Ran,
I'm sorry, his name is
His name is Desi Benjamin.
Desi Benjamin. Okay.
Well, if he ever wants to talk to somebody on We Talk Music, then you can show.
Yeah,
me
that sounds like somebody we'd love to talk to.
That sounds like a guy. Yeah, for sure, he would be a guy you would want to talk to because the good thing about him is he remembers everything.
Wow. So yeah, I didn't mean to cut you off there, but just yeah, it was what the hell's his name?
Yeah, I know. I mean, when it was funny because as I'm chatting with him, I literally we talked for about an hour and a half on tape, and then after that, we ended up talking for about 3 hours because he reminded me of so many things that had happened, and I was like, wow, that happened? I'm like, really? You know, my band did that? I'm like, wow, I didn't, you know, like, thank you. I appreciate this. It's like going to a hypnotist.
Awesome. We'll give you another name here, Brett.
All right. Well, let's go into some drummers then. What about Ginger Baker?
He seems nuts. Have you seen that documentary?
Yes. Love it.
Is it Ginger Baker? Yeah.
Yeah, it is.
He's crazy. He's fucking nuts. I mean, he's a great. I mean, he rode across like the Sahara in his Range Rover or something.
Yeah,
he's batshit.
Yes, he's definitely.
Oh, you mean drummer wise?
Drummer wise, well, everything, whatever you think. As a drummer, we know he's good, but well, actually, as a person, we know he's batshit crazy.
I was never a fan until I saw the documentary. And now I'm a huge fan because he's out of his fucking mind.
It's amazing.
I mean, I always knew he was a little bit crazy, but God, man, jeez, he's nuts.
Well, I love the story of Eric Clapton like forming Blind Faith just so that he could try to get rid of him, and then Baker like showing up like, so when are we starting? You know?
Yeah, I know. It's like, what the fuck? I get him. I always get Ginger Baker confused with Mitch Mitchell.
Oh yeah.
And Mitch Mitchell is another kind of like weird, crazy guy. Years ago, there was this club in Hollywood called the Coconut Teaser, and they would have jam nights. And so it would be like you'd have anybody, and this was like back like during the, if you remember, like there was a band called Rock City Angels that Johnny Depp was in.
Yep.
So you would have members from like, you would have like somebody like Johnny Depp going up there jamming with Duff on drums, and you know, any random guitar player that was in town. And I remember going up there, like Junkyard went up there, basically we went up there to do two songs, and then we were going to jam on some Ted Nugent stuff or do whatever. We went up there as a band, and Mitch Mitchell was up there, and I'm like, dude, this is my band, I'm gonna play. And Mitch just looked at me and goes, no, you're not. He goes, I'm jamming, this is my drum stool tonight. And I'm like, yeah, but this is my band. And he goes, I'm Mitch Mitchell. I'm like,
awesome.
I'm like, it's all yours. Go crazy.
How about another guy who we unfortunately lost last year, Tommy Ramone?
Oh, geez. What can you say? I mean, just song after song after song. I mean, to have that stamina. You know, he's a guitar player's drummer. You know, he's one of those guys. To me, I like him a lot because he plays off of the guitar. You know, he's not a bass player guy. You know, he's not like a drummer that's sitting there with a bass player trying to figure out like which pattern to play. No, he plays like straight ahead with the guitar, and just as soon as the song is done, it's like right on to the next one. Anybody that can play 20 songs in a row without taking a break, please. You're pretty high up there in my book.
Yeah.
So then, who's better, John Bonham or Keith Moon?
At what, drinking?
Well,
I think they both lost that battle.
Yeah, I think that
ship has sailed. Yeah.
Oh God, that's a hard one. Then it really gets into the Zeppelin versus the Who, but I'd have to go with Mooney, mostly because Bonham had the beat. He really knew how to throw it down. Mooney was all over the place, but he also turned the drums into a guitar. I mean, it was like every drum that he hit was like a guitar string. you know? So it's like, you know, if you hear, to listen to Keith Moon isolated, it's like listening to a guitar player do a guitar solo. It's like, you know, you can, but also he's like so syncopated. He's all over the place, but it makes sense. It's almost like, he's like a jazz player, man. I mean, he's just like, it's nuts. He's playing a different time signature than everybody else in the band, but it makes sense. I guess the world's first punk rock drummer.
Here's a piece of trivia I bet you didn't know. Janie Lane, now we go back to him just for a moment, started his career as a drummer, and in fact did the drums on some of their later albums. There's a little something for you.
That makes sense, because the drummer in Warrant was pretty weak.
Which is why he went back when it was time to do a Best Of album and redid the drums, I think.
Oh, did he really?
Yeah, he did. Yeah.
Excellent. Good.
Maybe that's why they weren't there that night. Maybe that's why they didn't show up. Carmen, I always assumed I'm going to pronounce
Carmine Appice.
Carmine Appice. I always want to say Carmen Appice.
Yeah, I don't know. Big hair.
That's weird.
I don't know. Never a fan.
Never a fan, really.
He had a gong, right?
Yeah.
I don't know. You know, never really took the time to listen, I guess. I mean, I don't know. Not a guy that, like, you know, inspires me, I guess.
No, I guess what you need is a documentary that shows he's batshit crazy and you'll be a huge fan.
That's right.
Exactly, yeah. If the guy's crazy or, you know, but, yeah, I don't know. He just, trims his mustache too nice.
That mustache has been on that man for a very, very, very long time.
Yeah,
I think it's tattooed on like John Waters' mustache.
All right, let's see. Well, why don't we break out of the drummer mold? So, Steve Jones.
Oh, Jonesy, love him. Kind of a creepy guy. he was around during Sucker Punch. I ended up sitting on his lap a lot. He's a funny guy.
Oh boy.
He's a very jovial guy, filled with jokes, an amazing rhythm guitar player. He'll be the first one to tell you he's not a great lead guitar player. I think he's another one. He's a drummer's dream, you know. He really knows how to play the fucking rhythm guitar. He knows how to play the rhythm out of a guitar.
Yeah.
Solo, I love his two solo albums from that era there. I think they're...
It was a Fire and Gasoline.
Fire and Gasoline is one of my favorite albums of all time, but Mercy is the other one, first one.
Yeah, brilliant guy, hilarious comedian, just you know, during when Sucker Punch was around, and he was a good friend of the band, partly because the guitar player that was in Sucker Punch also was the second guitar player. He was the backup guitar player in the Steve Jones band. He was also the backup guitar player in the Cult. So,
oh yeah, wow.
So therefore Jonesy was always around, you know.
All right, Joe Strummer.
Gone. He should still be alive. Yeah. Sad. You know, one of the world's best songwriters. She's just, you know, left us too early.
You know, I mean, I know that at the end of his career, he was sitting there touring, and I mean, he's literally making the best music of his career. And doing everything he can to get people to hear it. And, you know, people not realizing that's Joe fucking Strummer. Like, he shouldn't have to come to your radio station and bang on the door. He's a legend.
Yeah.
You know? It's sad what people can do to people in the music industry that are legends. It's sad the way that they can treat them or dismiss them.
I had heard stories like towards the end, like he was playing in front of like, oh God, like 20 people or something like that. And
playing,
you know,
the best music of his life.
Yeah, exactly. You know, and it's just, it's a guy that, you know, I guess people that appreciate music, you know, strummers, you know, I guess people that really take music seriously, strummers is probably on everybody's top five as far as songwriters go and as far as musicians go.
So I want to ask about a guy that that did a little bit of work with you on your first album, Earl Slick.
He was cool. He was a nut. He had big hair.
Yeah, it's funny because now he's got like next to no hair because I think he's in the Dolls, eh?
That's right. Yeah, he Earl was cool. When we were laying down tracks, we were doing the special guest tracks, and I was in there partly because there was nothing else to do. And Werman was like, why don't you come down so we can at least get some percussion down? We can do some more shakers and tambourines and stuff like that. And we were at a studio I think it was West Hollywood somewhere. And the day that I came down, I struck gold because I don't even think the band knew that Earl was coming down. Not only did Earl Slick come down, but Al Cooper came down that same day. And Dwayne from Molly Hatchet came down to lay down some guitars. So that day was, and these guys, you know, of course, all they had to do was hear the song once, and then they played their part on it. So it was amazing to have those three guys knock out, like, to be on our record. But those guys were in there for one day, you know, and I got to see all three of them. I think I was the only member of the band that was there that day.
My friend, you have lived one hell of a life. Speaking of big hair, I don't think anybody had a bigger hair than Dee Snider.
Yeah, and a bigger head, and a big head.
Oh yeah.
They were cool. I guess from a personal standpoint, he was when we did the festival down in Spain. And we had a layover in Madrid, and it was a long layover. And you know, it's we're hanging out in one part of the air, or right at the gate in Madrid. And you know, there's the Junkyard Camp on one couch, and then there's Twisted Sister on the other. And nobody was talking to each other. You know, everybody was just sitting there. Finally, I was just like, well, I'm going to go up and talk to one of the guys and just say, hey, you know, it's cool meeting you, and this is kind of cool that we're going to be on this bill together. And I went up to D, and it was just, I sat down next to him and I said, hey man, my name's Pat. I guess we're playing together in a couple of days. And he kind of looked at me and he like went to like, you know, like shush me. He went like, shh, like, you know, I'm reading.
What?
And I looked at him and I'm like, whatever. And I walked over to one of the other guys. I think it might've been the road manager or something like that. So I started talking to him. He's like, oh, no, you never bother D when he's reading a script. And I looked at him and I'm like, well, fuck that shit, whatever. So, and then the night that we played with him, everybody had their own rooms backstage. And, you know, we were going back and forth and back and forth. And so all of a sudden, Twisted Sister shows up with their big entourage, and they're in their like football outfits or whatever their outfits were that night. I mean, they had every kind of thing on imaginable that you could buy. And we got kicked out of our backstage room because D wanted his treadmill there.
Wow.
And we literally had to grab all of our stuff and take it out of the room and put it into another room because that was his room to do his workout. And I looked at him and I'm like, you're a tool. You should go. I go, you have more makeup on than like, you know, Hollywood prostitutes.
You know, the thing is, for the diva attitude you're saying he has, he wasn't that big a star. I mean, there are two,
no,
there are two,
yeah,
under. And he managed to reinvent himself again. But, I mean, I read his autobiography, and I can tell you, it's incredibly rare for you to read an autobiography where the other guy, where a guy's giving his side of the story, and you come out of it liking him less, which is what I did.
Yeah, he's a, I guess, I don't know, for lack of a better word, I guess he's a kind of a dick.
Well, tell us what you really think.
Don't hold back. What's the word on the street? He's a dick, and I'll go to my grave saying that. Although we still will play a show with him if something. I may be crazy, but I'm not that crazy.
He's not going to listen to this, I'm sure of it.
Yeah.
Oh, that is great.
Last name. Bunny Carlos.
Bunny Carlos, yeah.
He can play, he's ambidextrous. I guess, you know, when I was in Sucker Punch, we got to tour with him, and Bunny was in the band that he was touring with him then. A very approachable guy, very confusing person, because I don't know what he was talking about half the time. I wanted to really talk to him about snare drums in general, like, because he plays Ludwig snare drums. And I've been with, you know, a couple different drum companies in my life, one with Pearl and with EW. But I've always played Ludwig snare drums. And I just wanted to talk with him about really why he plays Ludwig. I have no idea what he was talking to me about. He went off into weird science land and started talking about the steel and, how it was heated up to blah, blah, blah. And I'm just like, dude, I just want to know why you like them. Professor Carlos, exactly. What are you talking about? I think, another guy I dig on the way he plays, because it's just so he's got that weird jazz feel about it, yet he's playing rock. And, I know I don't know exactly what the deal is between him and Cheap Trick now, but Rick's son does a really good Bunny Carlos impersonation on drums. I mean, except for those, thank God he doesn't, smoke while he's playing, but I don't know. Do you guys know what the deal is with him? Did he stop touring with them? Did he quit? Or
no, I actually don't know. I don't know very much about the later years. Cheap Trick.
Yeah, I know that he's got his own band, but I'm in the dark. As far as that goes, but as far as drummers go, I like Rick's son, I think his name is Dax. I think, he does a really good, he plays a good, solid Bunny Carlos to the new Cheap Trick.
Awesome. Well,
and as far as other drummers, there's Zach Starkey, too, who I think is just phenomenal.
Well, he's got some pretty good genes in there.
Yeah, pretty much, yeah.
So then, I want to know, when are you getting some Junkyard merchandise up on the website? Because I'll tell you this right now, Pat, I really want a Junkyard T-shirt.
I really want that rock card.
And that rock card.
I can give you one of those. Bucket full of those. We're working on.
We're Santa Monica.
Yeah, just come on down. I'll just throw it from the window. The merchandise, we're basically getting the website back up and running again, with the Spain tour. We're coming up with some merchandise ideas, and obviously we're going to go with the standard, which is the spade, and then we're also going to do the, I guess what we refer to as the Axel shirt, because, it's the one that he wore, because we gave it to him, and he wore it in a couple photo shoots, and, so we're doing the spade. We're doing the Axel shirt. We're also going to be making little buttons, or 1.5-inch pins, like the old school, the 80s new wave pins. So we're doing a spade pin. We're going to have stickers that are just, the band logo, not the spade, but just the Junkyard. When we get back from Spain, our merchandising store should be stocked. We also are working on a new design that is not a new logo, so to speak, but we're working on a new kind of different idea, I guess, similar to something like Turbo Negro would have, something that's pretty different for us, but But once, I guess, you see it, you'll go, okay, this makes sense, you know. And so we're doing that and, you know, throwing around some ideas on some other merchandising ideas, like we're, you know, thinking about the tote bags and, you know, so you can go to your market with a junkyard bag. You know, you put your beer in the bag so that way you don't have to waste, you know, we're giving back to the environment.
Awesome.
Tremendous.
While making 50 cents, you know.
Well, thank you so much. Oh, go ahead, Brett.
Well, anywhere you can make some money, I totally approve, you know, because I do hope that at some point we'll get a chance to see you because well, we love junkyard.
Yeah, absolutely.
And, well, and we're working on that. And that's something that, you know, our Facebook page really, you know, we really understand how everybody, you know, they post, and everybody's been so supportive on our Twitter account, on our Facebook page, that we do understand, like, when we post something, everybody says, you know, come to Iowa, come to Indiana, come here, come there. It's not that we don't hear those people, because we do, and we're the problem is that, you know, it's, for the United States, it's a bit tough to sometimes go and play, you know, on a Friday night in, like, you know, in Chicago, and then a Saturday night in Detroit, because we all have jobs and we can't really tour. We can't do a full blown U.S. tour, but we're working on 2016. We're really looking at doing a couple weekends a month and flying out and doing major markets. So, you know, we're going to be out there in 2016 doing, you know, East Coast stuff, you know, doing a couple shows, probably, you know, 2 to 3 shows a month. And, you know, that way we can get out there, and we know that some people were, you know, may get upset that we're not going to hit their town, but we're trying to make it, you know, hit the major markets. So that way people, unfortunately, they may have to drive 100 miles, but at least, you know, we're going to be out there playing a club where they can actually come up and talk to us, rather than playing some revival festival where we're on a boat and, you know, everybody's getting seasick and, you know, we're playing with, God forbid, we play with Trickster, you know.
I'm really glad it's, I didn't,
you know,
have to drink,
and we,
spit it out.
You know, we know that, you know, people that like us and the stuff that's played on Hair Nation, you know, it's cool. And, but we're, you know, I don't think like Junkyard, Queensryche, and Steelheart would be a really good show. I don't think that people would have fun at seeing us play with Steelheart.
Right.
And I don't even know what Steelheart is.
Oh, actually, no. I'd probably just be like, oh, forget it. I'm just hanging out with Junkyard.
Yeah,
exactly. And it's like one of those things. Would somebody rather be on a boat with us or at a club where, you know, the club isn't going to sink, and you know, you're not having to deal with, like, the craziness that's, like, you know, Tesla fans. And, you know, Tesla's cool and stuff, but, like, you know, come on.
Actually, they're probably one of the bands I think is most like you guys, where they got kind of pushed into a hair metal. They did have that song, Love Song, which kind of ruined their reputation as this, like, glam metal, hair metal band, when they're a little more, I don't know, a little more depth to them, I think.
There's a lot more depth to them, yeah, for sure. I mean, you don't see them running around, like, with, like, you know, fringe and conchos and, you know, tucked in crazy cowboy boots, you know, at the age of 50. It's like, you know, it's like, oh, okay, it's time to, like, get out the blue-black hair dye and get my hair extensions going because I'm playing, you know, M3 or whatever. You know, it's like, M3 is, and that's another one. I mean, those things are cool, but I think sometimes the promoters may want to take a cue from Europe, where they, where you've got, like, such a different lineup, but you've got, like, you know, a band like Dokken playing with Slipknot, you know, weird shit like that.
Not a good
thing. And you know, that's, I guess that's where we kind of get, you know, bummed. And we've been offered, you know, to play the Monsters of Rock Cruise thing, and we've been offered to play the M3 thing, and it's just been like, you know, it's not a matter of, it's not really a matter of money or anything like that. It's more a matter of, you know, who we're playing with. You know, we're in the same town as LA Guns. We're in the same town as, you know, some of the other bands, but we're nothing like them.
No.
So, you know, it's just,
but you'll
you know,
play with the sister. I mean, you'll, that's fun.
Well, yeah, of course.
Yeah.
We've already, hey, we're old friends, you know, we're in the south of Spain together.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for shooting the shit with us. Is there anything else?
Oh, no, anytime, man, anytime.
Well, don't say that because we'll ask you tomorrow.
we'll be back. Sounds good. Don't keep me up too early, but, again, like I said, you know, if something does, you know, happen, then, you know, you guys, you know, we'll let you know. We don't, you guys aren't going to, you know, hear it from a press agent or anything like that. So, you know,
hold
we'll,
on. If just 1 second, high five, Brett. Woo! There you go.
We'll give you guys the exclusive scoop.
All right. That'd be great. And do we have your permission to put a song or two on the end? Was there any song you'd like us to throw in the end of the for people to hear?
What, any song to close out the interview?
Yeah.
I'd have to probably say Lost in the City.
Nice.
You know, here's something. Every time I'm driving around in California, every time I get on a freeway, I'm like, that's all I can think of in my head is Lost in the... Can you give me directions to the freeway?
Oh, that's perfect. And we will absolutely
and that was
do that.
Back, that was pre-GPS. So.
Yeah. We'll absolutely do that. We'll absolutely put Simple Man on at the end for you. And sorry.
Oh, no, that's, you know, we have a running joke. Like, I named my daughter Simple Man, you know.
We were wondering if there was a member of the band that was... Who's the member of the band that's the Simple Man? Who is that guy?
Yeah, which is that guy? Probably the best thing, and I'll leave this as the last one, was when we were on the road with Lynyrd Skynyrd, we were actually playing in Montreal, and we were playing at a theme park in Montreal, and the two things were funny. One, seeing the Confederate flag go down, and everybody just going crazy. We're like, what? Like, you know, at that point we were laughing about it. We were like, oh, it was just kind of funny, you know. And then the second one was as we were walking around, obviously, you know, we were not at the theme park there because we, you know, are tourists or anything like that. But some guy and his daughter came up to us, and the daughter was very young, and she came up to me and our bass player, Todd. And she went up to us and she's like, which one of you is Skinny Lynyrd? And, you know, that was pretty much the way the Lynyrd Skynyrd tour kind of went. So,
oh, no.
A lot of fun stuff.
That is awesome.
Awesome.
Well, Patrick Muzinga, you have been a wonderful guest.
Oh, shit, you got it right.
Thank you, guys, man. I appreciate it. I appreciate
truly
you
hope...
letting me, like, yak your ear off.
Oh, no, this is what we live for, you know? I mean, this is why we do this, so that we can promote this kind of music, so that we can promote, you know, good music. And,
excellent.
And honestly, I mean, Junkyard, one of my absolute favorite bands. I will never not have a Junkyard album nearby, so thank you so much for this.
I appreciate that.
And I definitely look forward to hearing from you in the future.
Absolutely. We got one last Baba Booey from you?
Talk Top Toofy.
Awesome.
You know, I lost my life. I'm not gonna get into the whole Gary tape.
My life is, what is it? My work life is a full...
My professional life's a 10 and my personal life's a 1.
Yes, that's so great.
You know, I just miss you, that's all.
Oh, that's the greatest phone call ever.
that and the OJ one.
I still can't believe that he agreed. I don't remember what they paid him. They had to pay him money for it. I can't believe he let them put it on the air.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, they paid him a bunch of money, and he's like, all right, fine.
Awesome. You know, I love is Ronnie the limo driver.
Yeah, he's a short guy. he's funny. God, he's out of his mind.
I'm on an inside road. blame.